This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Today we're going to talk about the right to work law that was recently signed in Michigan, and we'll see what the background of that is and what could possibly be done about it, and a few other items. Stay tuned. All right, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. If you're just joining us from a Sirius XM audience, or if you're new to this program on this station, the show is here every day at 2 p.m., and it involves the issues brought up originally by the Occupy movement, and specifically income inequality, which in fact in America obviously covers everything. First couple of things before we talk to our guest today about the right to work law just signed in Michigan. One of the ways we continue this conversation off the air is on our Facebook page, Occupied Territory. So I invite everybody to go to Occupied Territory on Facebook. Just Google Occupied Territory on Facebook. And I post articles there. I post various rants, discussions, provocative, polite ideas. And other people post videos and express their opinion. It's kind of an ongoing debate, and we join in and try to figure out what's going on, maybe what to do about it. Also, I recently wrote an essay. I have another show on this network on PRN called The Turning Point, which is on Mondays at 4 p.m. It is not always political. It is sometimes about religion or culture, or I'll tell a personal story that has to do with something interesting. And I just recently wrote an essay. I was talking about the end of the world. The Mayans predict that in 10 days the world will end. We should be so lucky. But it's not going to end, so we still have to keep up the good work. And was it? No, it's not 10 days. Now it's only about 8 days that the world's going to end. Yeah, the Friday after this Friday. Anyhow, I wrote an article on my website. It's called Fader Files, FederFiles.com, FaderFiles.com, about organized religion, the end of the world, and how it relates to what's really going on in the world. All right. We have with us Roger Bybee, who has been a frequent guest of mine on. He's been here before once, and he was on Sirius XM show a few times. He's an expert on labor issues, and especially as they affect the Midwest. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you?
All right. Let me read some. I have this long biography of yours, which would go on for 20 minutes, but I'll try to, let's see. Roger's been working in the labor and community-based organizations for the past four decades, and he increasingly is focusing on writing and communications. In addition to writing, he teaches an online class on labor issues at the University of Illinois and Rutgers University. And he's worked with labor unions as an editor of the weekly Racine Labor newspaper in his hometown of Racine, Wisconsin, for 14 years. And let's see, his both his grandfathers were industrial workers, union members, and Socialist Party members, which was very big in Wisconsin once upon a time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's where Mr. Humphrey came from, right?
That kind of background. Minnesota.
Minnesota,
He was very popular in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I remember the first political event I went to was an event for Hubert Humphrey.
Yeah, all that all the socialist mayors there were in the 30s and 40s, you know, back in
right,
the,
absolutely. And there was 11 cities at one point in Wisconsin that had socialist mayors.
It's amazing. It's hard to believe right now. I mean, I'd like to see those days again. Maybe, who knows. Roger Bybee's father was also a socialist and helped to lead his union during one of the first strikes by public employee unions in Wisconsin in 69. Roger has been a member of the United Auto Workers, a union steward, and a leader for of a local labor community coalition that stopped four plant closings in his hometown of Racine. And let's see, he writes frequently, and the writing appears in numerous publications, including Z Magazine, The Progressive, In These Times, Dollars and Cents, American Prospect, Foreign Policy and Focused, et cetera, et cetera. So if people wanted to follow you regularly, where would they go on a regular basis?
Well, probably the easiest thing, Mike, would be typing in Roger Bybee, B-Y-B-E-E, plus Z space, and that'll get you to my website.
Okay, Roger Bybee. It's B-Y-B-E-E and Z space. Governor Snyder just signed this bill into law. It passed, the bill passed 58-51. Is that in the legislature or the assembly? They have two houses
there? It passed through both houses, okay. And there's actually two laws, one covering private sector unions, one covering public sector unions, and both have been signed into law by Governor Snyder. And he used thoroughly undemocratic means to ram these through. There were no hearings held on probably the most important legislation that's come up in Michigan in the last half century.
No public hearings at all.
No.
I mean, isn't that illegal? How can you pass a bill and sign it into law without any public hearings? I mean, isn't there a process that's a legal process?
There's a standard process, but apparently in Michigan, legislators can depart from that. They just have to allow for a space of 5 days between the introduction of a bill and its signing into law, and they use the absolute minimum. And also, none of the legislative candidates nor Governor Snyder, when he ran a couple years ago, ran on a platform of the so-called right-to-work legislation, and we should talk a little bit about what that means.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a little while because I want to clear up exactly what it is. But actually, maybe this is a good time to do that, and then we can talk about the process. But the process was extremely undemocratic, and it was pushed through, I presume, on an almost up-and-down straight party vote.
Right. That's my understanding, with one exception. The thing of it is that there's also been a number of other undemocratic measures passed in Michigan as well as other Republican-controlled states to exaggerate the Republican vote through redistricting so that in Wisconsin, for example, there was 174,000 more votes for Democratic legislative candidates in the state assembly, but instead of the composition reflecting that, the districts were chopped up so that instead of the Democrats having roughly a 53 to seat majority, they wound up with just 40 seats, with the Republicans holding 59.
Well, this whole thing about districts and gerrymandering.
That happened in Michigan as well, but still the Republicans actually lost seats.
So, because that's one of the questions that you ultimately ask. Well, we will get to the nuts and bolts of this in a second. But, you know, the question you ask is, do the people who live in Michigan, the people who live in Wisconsin, favor this? And probably the answer is no. But with states in charge of redistricting and gerrymandering, the situation remains, it's like a filibuster and one or two other things, like presidential debates. It's essentially permanently corrupt unless that kind of system is changed, right? I mean, it just perpetuates
a
minority control, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's happened throughout the Midwest and Virginia, where the Republicans are in control. In one state where there was a majority of Democratic votes for congressmen, the Republicans wound up with 10 seats and the Democrats with 3. In Wisconsin, there was a majority of Democratic votes for Congress, but the Democrats got 3 seats and the Republicans got 5. Mm-hmm. So you can see this consistent pattern where the public voice is ignored and the Democratic vote is diminished. And it's very intentional. The Republicans in Wisconsin, for example, used a very secretive process, and they repeatedly defied the courts in keeping their process as concealed as possible from the court and the public, and they were actually fined for contempt of the court for their efforts to hide what they were doing. But the Republicans, quite frankly, are really shameless about doing anything to win, and they're out to impose anti-democratic laws like right to work, and they're willing to use any undemocratic means to achieve that.
Well, just to be fair, when you look at it in a historical context, there are places where, in fact, the Democrats have done the same thing when they were in charge, right?
Well, I think that's true, and I'm very critical of the Democratic Party, and anybody who looks at my writings can see that. But there is, we are in a really extraordinary time where there's two characteristics of the Republican Party. Just an extreme loyalty to corporate America's priorities and their agenda. And at the same time, a willingness to use any undemocratic tactics to win. And so we have an extreme concentration of wealth and income that's getting worse all the time, and that's translated into an extreme concentration of political power and service to corporate America.
You know, as long as we've wandered off into this conversation, and I promise we will get to, you know, what is a right to work law, et cetera. But since we wandered off into this, the question becomes, if in fact the people who make the laws are lawless, what is the response of people who are average citizens? If you can't work to change the law because the people who make the laws or who are in charge of enforcing the laws are lawless people who work for a rich minority, then what's your alternative?
Well, basically, grassroots activity, and it can come in many forms, like the Occupy movement, which maybe did not achieve the winning of a lot of specific reforms, but did really transform the debate in America and increase the awareness of how unequal America's wealth is being shared. Mm-hmm. For example, in 2010, the top 1% collected 93% of all income gains in America. That same 1% in any typical year gets almost a quarter of all the income in America. So the top 1% gets 24% of all income, and then the remaining income is spread among the 99%.
Well, I think this show has been talking about that for over a year now. It is called Occupy
right.
Territory, about the Occupy movement. The question is, what or how is this grassroots organizing going to take place? Because, in fact, to be even more clear about things, you've got a Democratic Party, which, as far as I can tell, is at least half or two-thirds in thrall to the same people who are financing the Republican Party.
You've got right.
You've got a president right now who's supposed to be a Democratic president who's perfectly willing to bargain away people's retirement age and their benefits and everything else to appease a bunch of bankers and rich people. I don't know what you do about a thing like that, you know.
Well, I think we're in an interesting perhaps transitional time because labor and grassroots groups are really fully mobilized to put pressure on the president to keep true to his word and impose higher taxes on the top 2% and to maintain the key safety net programs on which the lives of tens of millions of people really depend. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and without those, there would really be mass destitution in America, and America would look much more like the pre-New Deal America before Franklin Delano Roosevelt came into office.
Well, since he's already indicated his his willingness to bargain away some of these of the very things you're talking about, and believe me, they affect me personally too. You know, you could send him 1 million tweets, you could send him 2 million signatures on online petitions. It's not going to make any difference. You're talking about something else, I hope, right?
Well, from what I've seen, labor and its allies and labor has finally gotten the understanding that they do need allies, they do need coalitions with people of color and senior citizens and a whole array of social justice groups, and they're willing to take to the streets. So I think there's a lot of pressure on Obama from the grassroots not to compromise on, for example, the Social Security and, mm-hmm. and Medicare eligibility ages. So there's an enormous amount of focus on that, and it would not be out of character for Obama to cave in on that, but to do so at this moment in his presidency would really doom his second term, and I think doom him in history, and he understands that.
Well, yeah, he is interested in how it goes down in history. Apparently that's more important to him than anything else. You know what? Let us actually go to the issue at hand. What is a right-to-work law? What does that mean? First of all, it's one of those phrases that the Republican branding people came up that almost means the opposite of what it says, right?
Exactly. It's really a masterful phrase because it's so deceptive. It guarantees no rights whatsoever. It provides no work whatsoever. What it's about is the notion that the government can single out unions as the only institution in which or from which people can take benefits without paying for the cost of getting those benefits through collective bargaining and lobbying and representing people in court if necessary, so that under the right to work, so-called right to work laws, unions are obligated to represent every worker in their workplace, even those who are not paying fees for the cost of representing them. So
when you say fees, do you mean union dues?
The equivalent of union dues.
Okay.
Right. Because under Supreme Court rulings, you cannot make union membership mandatory as a condition of work, but you can require people to pay for the cost of the bargaining and representation needed to get the benefits of working at that particular place.
Well, it sounds like, it sounds a little bit like semantics. In other words, you could call them fees if you want, but in fact, they are a kind of dues, right?
Yeah, well, they're the equivalent of dues, and I'm not trying to play any semantic deception games, but there is the proponents of right to work basically say we're against mandatory union membership. Well, they're against unions, but they're even more crudely against the notion that people can reasonably be required to pay for the benefits that unions win for them and the representation that unions provide for them.
Mm-hmm.
So under so-called right-to-work laws, if a non-union member in a workplace were fired unjustly, the union would be required to go to the wall and hire lawyers at untold cost to represent that worker, even though that worker is contributing no union dues as a member or no fees as a non-member.
So ultimately, the effect of a right to work law will be to weaken or destroy a union or make it unable to do adequate representation of its workers, right?
Right. And in the majority of the interests of the majority of the society, because what unions have done for all their many flaws and I've cataloged them in my writings, they have stood up for civil rights for people of color. Like Walter Reuther was right there at the March on Washington and marches in the South with Martin Luther King. Walter Reuther was the president of the UAW, a real major historic figure. The union movement strongly opposed the war in Iraq. It has advocated for equal rights for gays, fought for environmental legislation. Doesn't have a perfect record. The union movement doesn't have a perfect record on that, but in general, they've worked closely with environmental groups, and in every consumer group or women's group trying to promote greater equality and a cleaner environment and better conditions for average Americans. So the goal of right-to-work laws is to basically take one of the opposing teams entirely off the playing field. Union right-to-work laws, it's no accident, started in the old slave states of the Confederacy, where there was a tradition of bosses having really tight control over labor, both black and white. And the right-to-work laws enabled them to keep union membership extremely low. So at a point where it was 40% or better in many northern states, it was 5-7% or sometimes less throughout the South as of 30 years ago. But essentially, the right-to-work laws established a lower wage standard throughout the South, and more U.S. industry migrated to the South, and it drove down living standards throughout the country. But nonetheless, we know, it's documented, that household incomes in right-to-work states are $6,400 a year less than in states where people have the right to have everyone in a workplace paying union dues or fees so that the union is strong and can be a real force.
Obviously, from the very beginning, from the inception of the union movement, let's say around the year 1900, give or take, you know, a decade, and then moving on up through the 20th century, you know, companies, bosses, corporations have never wanted unions. They've tried everything they could to get rid of unions, including violence, murder, jailings, cooperation with various governments. Why is it that after all the successes of the unions through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and up, why is it that finally unions are on the wane in this country? Why is it that they're sort of basically beating a retreat all over the place and being diminished? What changed?
Well, there's two sets of factors. One has to do with unions themselves not being activist enough in terms of involving and educating their members and really being more than lobbying groups in the state capitals and then negotiating for traditional increases in wages, better benefits, and working conditions at the workplace. And given the way labor confined itself, it didn't inspire its membership sufficiently. But the, I think a larger factor, apart from labor's failings, is a class war that's basically been going on since the mid-70s by corporate America, where corporate America started to go global, and because it could find cheap labor in very repressive nations like Mexico or China or Indonesia, wherever, it began to ship increasing numbers of jobs there, backed up by so-called free trade agreements that are really investment protection agreements. And
so this inevitably has to weaken American unions and American workers if people are going to compete on an assembly line or any other job with somebody who makes in another country who makes a 50th of what they do, then there's no hope. Right.
No, exactly. And, but what's very significant and a lot of people don't understand is that most of the trade that U.S. corporations engage in is internal. It's General Electric sending parts to Mexico to be assembled and then the finished product being sent back to the U.S. To be sold. Mm-hmm. That's the majority of that's over two-thirds of the trade with Mexico. And in general, it's a majority of trades happening within corporations. So it's basically a GE worker in Louisville, Kentucky, competing with a GE worker in Mexico at a tenth or the 20th of total labor costs.
Well, if that's the way that these things are, and these trade agreements have progressed through every form of president and administration, I mean, in fact, Clinton seemed to be the one who pushed these things more than anybody else. And now, in fact, we even have Obama and the Democrats, although who knows who's involved in this, because Congress itself is shut out, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in other words, he's expanding all this stuff, which has killed the American labor force and American workers' rights. So it's something that seems to be bought into by both parties. And if this
at the top levels, and what's interesting, Mike, is that we have such an undemocratic political system at this time. That a Wall Street Journal poll showed that 86% of Americans were convinced in 2010 that a major part of the ongoing economic problems that America had then and still has now were caused by moving jobs offshore.
Mm-hmm.
86% of Americans, nearly 9 out of 10 people, and the vast majority of people oppose the notion that corporations ought to be able to move jobs to Mexico or China or wherever in order to take advantage of the 21st century version of slave labor.
Or in fact, as we recently see, something like Bangladesh, you know, the newest version of the Triangle Shirt Wars fire. But here, let me ask you this question, and it seems to be the same question I keep asking all the time. If the vast majority of Americans are aware of that and don't like it, why is it that every administration since the 70s and the 80s has completely ignored the vast majority of Americans and successfully been able to negotiate all these treaties which have ruined the vast majority of America's living standard? Am I missing something here?
No, you're absolutely right. And what's happened is that there's been a growing concentration of wealth, and that translates into inordinate political power for the top 1%, and
they also
persuade Congress to pass laws that will increase their wealth and power through free trade agreements, through anti-labor laws like right to work. Basically, the goal now is to, given that a majority of the American people through polling consistently showed they want an end to offshoring, they want a true universal health care system.
Yeah, they wanted to end the war 10 years ago. None of these things make any difference to the government.
Right, they don't get translated into policy because you have on one side this inordinate power of the 1%, but the vast majority of the American people are not organized in institutions like unions to have a real political voice at the table.
What is going to be
the precise goal of a right to work, to take labor out of the game,
well,
to
what,
take
all right,
so, organized force out of the game.
Well, all these things have been very effective, the things you mentioned, against labor, against American citizens' right, against what the majority wants. What is going to, or what or who is going to get people to finally wake up and join unions and for the unions to join with other groups? Now, earlier you said that the unions historically and in other ways, not so long ago, join with groups against this, against the war, for civil rights, for women's rights. In fact, I remember very clearly when I was out on the streets protesting the Vietnam War, which could be a dangerous occupation. And one of the reasons was not just because of the cops who used to beat up on us, was because every place we went, union guys, electrical workers, construction workers with their hard hats and their goddamn flags were throwing bricks at us. So in other words, we have been up against a lot of union people. People like me on the left don't really like union people all that much because they've been hard asses.
Well, I think that the picture was much more complex because like even in 1970, at a time shortly after construction workers were beating up guys like you in New York City, and the construction unions were generally in the right wing of the labor movement and had a very narrow view of unionism. There were other unions like the United Auto Workers under Walter Reuther that were strongly speaking out against the Vietnam War. And at that same point in 1970 that you're talking about, I remember working with the United Electrical Workers Union, which was also strongly anti-war and fighting the export of jobs and fighting for civil rights. They welcomed students who were part of the anti-war movement with open arms. So there's really contradictory currents in the labor movement at that time.
But now is a time when all of these groups that you mentioned better join forces or else it'll be curtains for them, right?
Right. That's true. And one of the problems, however, is that while labor has been, in a sense, the aircraft carrier for a lot of social movements, in a sense, as the support for a lot of different social movements, it's still a shrinking presence in American society, and the new attacks on it in Michigan and Wisconsin and elsewhere threaten to shrink its strength even further. And so while a majority of Americans may hold really surprisingly progressive views on a range of issues, it's really hard to pull together them as an organizational force. People are busier than ever, working three jobs, having less vacation time, having no sick time. Both halves of a couple are working, and they have more child care obligations. So that it's in a sense harder to harness the opinions of the majority of Americans into an organized force. And labor has been traditionally one institutional basis that's been an ongoing presence and ongoing support for all these various social movements and as a political force.
Well, one of the other problems, obviously, is that let me bring this thing about, you know, and obviously I understand the complexity of what it is, because a lot of the left-wing people I know, especially at these radio stations I work, like BAI, the Pacifica Foundation, we were always buddies with the United Electrical Workers. They're famously liberal, even left-oriented union. But it was complicated. And in fact, it's still complicated because a lot of times I'll see people in private, in public sector jobs in New York City, all of whom belong in unions, and who are in private sector jobs, you know, like delivery guys, whoever is involved in various kinds of union activity. A lot of these people read the New York Post, they watch Fox News, and they vote against liberal policies and liberal people. You know, so the media, in other words, is saturated with, I mean, it's about 90% of the media in every form except on the internet is about right-wing messages, you know, and people lap them up.
That's an enormous problem about the media. Let me say, though, that the percentage of union people who voted for Obama was around 68 or 70%, so that the people within the union orbit of influence, people who were really being educated on the issues, voted in some fashion in alignment with their interests. And Obama was far from a perfect candidate, but certainly light years ahead of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. But one of the problems that you correctly point out in terms of the issue that I brought up about how do we organizationally harness the vast majority of people is that the media in this country are so commercialized and conservative. And for example, even the New York Times, mm-hmm. which provides a lot of valuable reporting and news information and opinion columns, has consistently, regardless of the evidence that's contained in its news pages, will editorialize in support of so-called free trade agreements mm-hmm. and globalization, and keep on contending that in the long run it will be good for all Americans and good for the American economy.
Well, that's against all evidence, obviously.
Right. Exactly. They ignore their own reporting to come up with those kinds of editorials. So one of the things that happens is that although Americans may develop progressive views on their own, if they're not within the orbit of some organization or do not find reliable internet sites, their views are not being reinforced, and they feel isolated, like other people are not supporting their point of view. And that's certainly discouraging, and I think creates a sense of fatalism about political activism.
Well, you know, occasionally, what would be interesting to see is a major union getting to a major union having its own website, its own news website, is what I'm saying. In other words, instead of a neutral website, there's nothing, since everything has been abandoned in terms of neutrality, you know, except maybe some places, right? Since there's no objective news that you could hardly find anymore, that's gone out the window. Well, I mean, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. Why not have the unions or a national conglomeration or amalgamation of unions publish their own news network, publish their own news site, you know?
That would certainly be worthwhile, because every union has its own website, but and the the Federation, the AFL-CIO, has a good website. But there's a need for something broader that touches on a wider range of issues. And I think that is something that's really lacking. And, you know, going back to how labor weakened itself, at one point, the labor movement owned radio stations in a lot of major cities like Detroit and Chicago, but gave them up. They felt, well, you know, we're able to bargain regularly with management, and and this is in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, and why do we need to keep putting out our message? And
well, that's too bad because that's fatally short-sighted.
Geared up for a class war.
Yeah, that's really fatally short-sighted. You know, it's terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now the licenses, you know, which by the way the people own, but never mind. The licenses for a lot of these stations are so prohibitive in cost that it would be almost impossible for unions to buy them back. All of this brings me to maybe one final general question, which is. If in fact, and we started this whole theme that runs through this conversation here is, you know, people who make the laws are in the pay of the rich people. They own the media. The unions have diminished themselves in some ways. So if the game is rigged, you have to sometimes go outside the game. In other words, one of the reasons why the war stopped in the 60s and one of the reasons why civil rights, at least the beginnings of civil rights and some major strides were passed and were achieved in the 60s was because people disobeyed the law. In other words, the game was rigged. So people said, okay, I'm not going to play this game. And they said, we're Americans. We have rights. This is what we want. They're ignoring us. They piled out on the streets. They sat in doorways. They occupied places. They got arrested. They got beat up. They got thrown in jail. But they stopped the machinery, right? And I wonder if you think that's possible anymore.
Yes, I do. And I think that's absolutely crucial. And I think the Occupy movement showed some of the strength of that approach of disrupting the normal routines of life on Wall Street and in the docks of Oakland and other places. But it really it was still a point where a lot of people were learning and didn't have the strategic focus that they needed. But I think ultimately labor and other forces for democracy, because I really do think...
Got to be students, too, by the way. Definitely students.
Absolutely. Right. And young people are really crucial to make any kind of major change in America. And a strategy of strategic disruption, of mass defiance, and this is advocated by a woman that you ought to get on your show, Frances Fox Piven, who more than anyone else was singled out by Glenn Beck for just an absolute campaign of vituperation, and she got a ton of death threats as a result. But she's still a very vigorous and courageous and brilliant advocate.
Still teaching in the City University system, too.
Right, yeah. And she's really, I think, one of the most key strategic minds about how labor and other small-d democratic forces can have an impact, and it is through mass defiance, raising hell with a purpose, disrupting routines with a purpose, disrupting the production flow, disrupting the supply chains with a purpose. And I think that is exactly the kind of thing that we need to do.
Now out in Michigan right now, we're coming to an end here for as far as this segment goes, but you've been listening, by the way, and you should pay close attention to Roger Bybee. It's B-Y-B-E-E, Roger Bybee, who is a longtime union and labor activist, and who does a great deal of writing on these issues. And he's up to date on all this stuff and has been mentioned, in fact, by Noam Chomsky as one of the better modern writers on labor. And Roger, why don't you tell, before I ask you the last question here, tell people again where they can follow your writings.
Sure. Go type in Roger Bybee plus Z space, Z okay. as in Z. space,
and that'll,
that'll take you to my website.
Okay, last question. Let's return to where we started or where all this is happening now. Now, we noticed that in Madison, Wisconsin, which was one of the early inceptions of where the Occupy movement got its fuel from, you know, not just the Arab Spring, but Madison, Wisconsin was our beginning of our protests there. And it was a massive protest. Unfortunately, in the end, it didn't work out so well, even electorally, finally, probably because of redistricting and gerrymandering. The vote to recall Walker and all those people didn't really work as well, although it did change the shape of the legislature in Wisconsin. However, back in Michigan, at last glance, there were 10,000, 20,000 people, mostly public employees and private employees, enraged. In fact, some of them engaged in a little civil disobedience of their own, and they ripped down the tent to belong to this this ridiculous front group, Americans for Prosperity. So people are out there and they're doing that, and the cops are responding. But, like as we've seen in the last couple of years, you know, demonstrations against the war, demonstrations in Madison, it looks like this is ultimately going to blow away. I mean, it seems to me that if we've ever had a time when the country is ripe for massive civil disobedience to change these things because the voting doesn't seem to work, that this is the time. I guess maybe we'll have to wait till the spring. I don't know. The Occupy movement, students, women's rights groups, gay rights, civil rights groups, and unions, it's all there waiting for them to do something about it. Otherwise, they will steal our teeth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you're right that the main strategic thrust has to be to capture the majority sentiment through and harness that toward protests that make a difference and turn around the routines of those in power. And, you know, for example, in Michigan, I think there ought to be sit-ins at the corporations and think tanks that supported the right to work bill. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there ought to be a one-day strike, general strike. You know, there's a lot of different strategies and tactics that can be pursued, but it really depends, number one, on understanding that we have the majority on our side, that democracy itself, as well as decent living standards for all Americans, or the bottom 99%, is at stake, and that, you know, we've got to use every tactic and strategy necessary to harness that majority opinion. And a lot of that will be strategically disruptive mm-hmm. activity that it harnesses mass defiance.
All right. Listen, thanks for coming on. And, of course, you'll be back here and then on the Sirius show as these things progress. So, Roger Bybee, thank you very much.
Well, a delight, as always.
Okay. And we're going to keep in touch with this with this issue, although in Michigan it looks like it'll probably wind up like it did in Madison, Wisconsin, with tens of thousands of people, you know, occupying the state house, protesting civil disobedience in Madison. What was interesting is the cops did not hurt anybody, did not bother anybody, because the police union was being attacked by these laws, too. And in fact, what is clever on the part of these bastards who sneak these laws past and represent rich people against the rest of us is that often when they do these things, right-to-work laws, and they impose all kinds of restrictions and they tromp all over labor, they exempt fire and police, especially like exempting the police department, because then the police department feels like, they're detached somewhat from the general complaint and the protests, and they can do their job against their own fellow workers. And that's a shame. That's the way it goes. Life is hard, right? You know, you're working as a cop, you're making $38,000, $42,000, $56,000 a year. You're barely getting by. You can hardly pay the mortgage, hardly pay the rent, hardly buy the food, hardly afford your kids' education. And you can't be taking any civil disobedience. You can't take a day off or refuse a direct order to thump somebody because they're enraged, they just lost their job. It's a rough thing. So it seems to me the only possibilities are twofold. One is, and these things can come at the same time or one before the other, but probably around the same time, is a uniting of student groups, the Occupy movement, unions, every other kind of group that has suffered and continues to suffer, homeowners, whatever it is, any unity, any group, any association. And in this case, one of the big sellouts, I should mention, is AARP. AARP, which is one of the largest organizations in this entire country, has like 35 million paying members, has frequently sold out older or elderly people. And people don't seem to know it. And you have to wonder then sometimes, are we too finally addicted to what Aldous Huxley called in his book Brave New World, SOMA? Are we too finally fatally addicted to entertainment? To our TVs, to our devices, to taking it easy, to letting other people take care of things, to just sitting back and letting everything flow into us through our headphones or through our eyes or whatever. We march off to the grocery store, to the supermarket. We notice that everything costs almost too much for us to afford. Oh, well, what can you do about it? Everybody. We're in this sense of passivity. It's like Stockholm syndrome. The whole country is in the thrall of Stockholm syndrome, where we've been kidnapped and held hostage by these brutes who really own and run the country and their hired politicians and their cops. And we just sit back and finally get depressed. Any psychologist will tell you that when somebody is constantly oppressed all the time and they try to fight back and their ability to fight back is taken away, they're held prisoner for so long, they become passive, they become depressed, and then you can do anything you want with them. All right. So number one is groups have finally got to say, I've got nothing left to lose, as Mr. Marx once said, and I don't mean Groucho, they have nothing less to lose but their chains. All of us. They're screwing us all over and getting away with it and laughing over their martinis at the country club or in their chauffeur-driven cars. How long do we let them get away with this? And it's not voting that's going to do it. Something like, whatever, is it 1 million people or 1,300,000 people more voted for Obama than the other guy? And Obama's sitting there, a rich man, making deals with other rich men on how to raise the retirement age and the eligibility age for Medicare. Life isn't bad enough. So old people, students, I mean, you name it, this will add up to, women's groups. This will add up to something like 90% of the actual population need to take it back. And it's going to have to be through a lot of people stopping the works, blocking the machinery, interfering with business as usual in an illegal manner. How it has to happen. People have to unite. All these groups have to see it together, and they have to unite to get rid of these people and to take away what they have and redistribute it. It's the only way it's going to work. The only way it's going to work. I mean, otherwise, they will keep on going on, and they will keep on going on. And you vote for Mr. Smiley, hope and change, good luck to you. He'll step all over you just as bad as any Republican. He's doing it right now. He's on the way to making a bargain that, so what? He goes down in history as not a great president. It doesn't make any difference to him. He is one of them. He is not one of us. And he's sitting there. You can sign all the petitions you want. Move on this. Move on that. Tweet, 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 tweet. We're all a bunch of birds here in this country. No, the only way is to get out and stop them. Stop them from doing business. stop them from occupy the halls of Congress, stop them from doing their business, surround the White House, you know, interfere with the way banks work, occupy the lobbies. They'll arrest. How many people can they arrest? Yeah, they got a lot of prisons. They can't arrest the whole country. That's the way it's going to have to work. If it doesn't work that way, little by little by little, you will wind up being a literal sheep. You might as well just learn how to say ba, ba, ba. And they'll come and shear you every 4 years or every 2 years. You know, it's not like I have all the answers. I'm just observing what I'm observing. And I'm seeing this based on a long life, being involved in these things myself, seeing how the media works, seeing how it all works. What do we have? I mean, everybody will get a new app, and everybody will get a new machine and a new device, and everybody will spend their lives staring at a screen, and they will not go out and take care of themselves. And while they're staring at the screen, somebody is stealing their sexual organs and their shoes and their bank accounts. Oh, look, I can't walk. I have no feet. They took them and sold them somewhere. This is the way it's going to have to work. If it doesn't, good luck to all of us.